We've had enough of friendlies. Things are about to start for serious. This is a football fans podcast and people behind CelticUnderground.net. This is the Celtic Underground podcast. Regular listeners to this will know that I like my stats. I'm not quite at the 90-minute cynic level and can't really be bothered preparing it myself, so I read other people's. One of the great people on Celtic Twitter for that, brought to my attention by Lawrence Donegan, have to give that away, otherwise Lawrence will be in a mad mood, is Duco James. So I contacted him and we've got a two-hour podcast talking about data, stats and football. As I talk through this, we're a million miles behind where we should be. And as I talk through this, it might sound like we're having a go at Scott Brown, and we're not. It really isn't. It's just that is a great example to use for this chat. So, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him. So I am now joined by a new guest on the podcast, but people may have been following him on Twitter. If you're into your stats, you'll have been following him. And if you're not into your stats, you'll be frustrated by those of us who retweet him. I'm joined by Duco James. How are you doing, James?
I'm well, Harry. How are you?
I'm excellent, thanks. And people may have picked up that is not a West of Scotland accent you've got there.
No, that's a Pennsyltucky accent. So as political consultants in the United States are fond of saying, you have Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and you have Kentucky in the middle, politically. So I live smack dab in the middle of Pennsyltucky.
You can have a whole raft of listeners getting out their cyclopedias trying to find Pennsyltucky.
That's right.
So do you want to give us a brief overview what the hell you're doing on a Celtic football podcast and how you've ended up being one of my new go-to guys for stats reinforce my beliefs in certain things. So how have you ended up being a Celtic stat obsessive?
Sure. So start off with my inheritance. So my mother was born and raised in Clydebank and emigrated to the U.S. at the age of 17 in 1967, followed her Irish cousin, and proceeded to meet my father a few years later, who was returning from Vietnam, and he's from Pennsyltucky originally, so in the middle of the state of Pennsylvania. So they got married, and it was a long journey from there. My mother wasn't really into sports growing up, but I was really a maniacal fanatic just across sports. But I didn't really kind of emerge onto the Celtic scene until I was in Scotland for 6 weeks in 2004 and stayed there with my new bride at the time, who was doing some schooling in Glasgow for a month. And my cousin took us to an Old Firm game, the Scottish Cup semifinal in March of 2004. And it was almost like a religious ceremony for me. It was very, it was overwhelming. I just had no idea what I was getting into. My uncle had started visiting in the late 90s, and he was a huge, you know, God rest his soul, he was a huge Celtic supporter. And so we would talk a lot about a lot of things in life when he started visiting in the late 90s. And one of those things was football and Celtic, and he was educating me at that time. So I kind of had a broad understanding, but that was kind of the start of it. And then in 2012, which really hit the accelerator, I happened to be in Manhattan for a bit for work and decided to check out Jack Dempsey's the CSC there for a Champions League game, and it happened to be the Barcelona game. And walked upstairs, and as I ascended the stairs and turned right to go into the Jack Dempsey's, Billy Connolly was sitting there, and I, of course, recognized him. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then proceeded to meet a bunch of people and watch the game, which obviously doesn't need any introduction or explanation. And then it was, you know, from there it was a full addiction that started to emerge. The data side of it really has only emerged in the last 12 months, and that's some of my career situation has evolved over the years. So I've been working from home the last few years, and I have a background in analytics and a little bit on the data side. And you know, just being a fan, I started to consume a lot more Celtic-related media and hearing opinions, and started to get some access to some data, poking around, just, you know, as a hobby. Started testing things, and more it just became a hobby where, you know, as you get older, like I am, I'll be 45 next month, and, you know, you wake up a lot earlier because your prostate's enlarged. And I have two dogs and a cat that don't let me sleep in. Between that and the prostate, I'm up by 6 all pretty much every morning. So there's about 2 hours there where the house is quiet. It's just me, coffee, you know, pull up the laptop and start messing around with some stats. So I guess you could say I'm a dork.
So before we go on to talking about a team, because there's a couple of things that you've highlighted in the last few weeks that I think are relevant for what's coming up. And we're also going to talk about data in football in general. What was going through your head about the first game that you attended, that Scottish Cup semi-final? Because most Americans are into sport, they like the sport, so you're a big sports fan. But it's a different type of atmosphere, a Celtic Rangers game. So I mean, was it the passion? Was it the almost hatred? I mean, what was it that really took you aback, or that you brought your attention to it?
Yeah, it was a combination of factors. First of all, my wife attended with me, so she's Peruvian, so she's an immigrant. Mm-hmm. She came to the U.S. when she was younger, and so her whole family, you know, obviously being Peruvian, football is a huge deal for them too. So she grew up more of a football fan than I was. From a long-term perspective. So she was excited to experience it. So it partly was kind of experiencing it with her. And when my cousin said that he had secured the tickets to go with us, the first thing he said is, you know, just make sure you don't wear the wrong colors. You know, obvious thing.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know, of course I asked, and yeah, you don't want to get in trouble. I was like, all right. So, you know, just walking up to the stadium, it being almost like a lockdown environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the U.S., there is no such thing as that kind of rivalry.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, and when you invited me on, I started to think about maybe an analogy to draw. The only one I can think of is like the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees in the 1950s, right? Where you have something in the city, where you have the same city generally, people working together, where there's just an intense hatred. But it's not, you know, sectarian. There's no ethnic or aspects with the legacy that you clearly have in Glasgow. So it's just a different animal altogether, and the intensity. And, you know, seeing the Rangers support section surrounded by, you know, I thought they were police at the time, the way they were dressed. I didn't know what was going on. I was like, oh, my God, what are we doing here? Like, this is crazy. And then the chanting and the singing started, and screaming at that section, and then them singing all kinds of stuff. And it was just, and then the level of speed and intensity of the game itself and the physicality was just, you know, it's like the first time you go to an NBA game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just watch it on TV or an NHL game, you know, which I had been to prior to my trip there. It's like that level of athleticism and the speed at which they play. And I think in that particular game, obviously, it's even crazier because of how physical, and probably more so than it is now. So that combination, I wish I had been less shell shocked by it, because I think I, you know, some of it's kind of foggy because I was mm-hmm. so just taken aback by the environment. My senses were so overwhelmed. I was just kind of looking around in a daze for quite a bit of it, I think. But it was an amazing experience.
So in terms of using data to analyse football, data is a much bigger thing, my perception anyway, in American sport. Data is part of the analysis of the game, prior to the game, post-game, discussions with fans. It's changing rapidly in football. but nowhere near. And obviously the most famous data-driven change in sport is probably the Moneyball thing with baseball. So was that something that you were always comfortable with, using data to analyse sport and then find it unusual that it wasn't the case in football?
Yes, a short answer, yes, because I had already been grounded in that aspect with baseball. I'm more of a, I come from a finance background, some understanding as a trained analyst and some accounting background. So data and stats were kind of natural to me anyway. I grew up memorizing baseball cards, the statistics on the back of a baseball card. Like, that's an authentically American thing that used to happen.
Yep.
For many decades, you get your favorite team and then you memorize all their stats and you look for the black type, which was when your favorite player led the league in a stat category, right? So that's much more, I think, just part of the baseball experience as a fan anyway. And then when Moneyball came around, I think the book came out in, 2005 or something like that. That really opened up this beginning of what's been happening in baseball and progressively other sports. And it's really permeating across society now. I mean, it's not just sports. I mean, sports is kind of on the edges of it, quite frankly, kind of slow in picking up some of it. And between what I was doing professionally at the time and then my fandom in baseball, I became very comfortable with it and watched kind of the behavioral evolution that took place in baseball, where you had, the broadcasters started picking up on it, the journalists started picking up on it, communicating in a common language about basic stuff. Maybe it's not the best idea to have your small shortstop who hits 300 that's fast lead off. Maybe the fat first baseman who walks a lot should be leading off, right? And we can prove that statistically, but there was a good 10 or 15 years there where people still argued about it, right? It's a bad idea. I mean, it's just, you can prove it. Like, it's not something that's really up for debate. There's a statistical relationship, but I mean, one of the big things in baseball is getting on base, not making an out. And that's basically what Moneyball was. It wasn't anything terribly complicated, but, recognizing that the earth isn't flat isn't complicated conceptually, but until you actually, that switch goes off in your brain, oh yeah, it's round. I mean, I've been looking at the earth my whole life and it looks flat to me, until someone, wow, that's a big deal. That switch is sometimes slow to flip for people because, people get comfortable and they see the world and their game that they love and the players they love in a certain way. And when they get confronted with this evil data stuff that might question those beliefs, people don't like it sometimes. And I watch that. So we exchanged in preparation for this. I joked, I feel like Marty McFly in a sense because of how I experienced this in baseball as a fan and an early adopter of analytics in that fandom. And then watching what's going on in global football and seeing basically the same script start to play out. Only this script is probably going to be faster. That's my intuition. That's not, certainly could be wrong on that. But the horsepower of the technology is vastly stronger now than it was, let's say, in 2007 or 2008 with baseball front offices. And that's because of big data. That's because of machine learning. And the idea that it was controversial just a few years ago for Scottish, and maybe in some clubs it's still controversial for Scottish football players to have a good diet, that was controversial.
Yeah.
It speaks volumes to where we're at because, if you're going to argue over nutrition at that level, getting into things like XG models and the fact that the XG models that most people talk about right now are already hugely outdated, and you're going to have new XG models in the next 5 years that are going to transcend anything that you have right now. And most of the the software vendors and most clubs that think they know what they're doing with XG now, that they're event driven or even possession driven. However they're doing the model now, it's going to just change massively in the next 5 years because that's what happened in baseball. And I can see it lining up. Right. And I'm not a soothsayer. I don't have a crystal ball, but it's not hard to figure out that it's going the same route. So the question is, you know, which clubs are going to be early adopters, which ones are going to be middle adopters, who's going to be late to the game. And, you know, it's really a question of culture and commitment. Because that's the crazy thing is it's to do this, given the budgets that most of these clubs are spending on other things, it's not a lot of money relative to address these issues. It's whether you turn the pyramid upside down, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what a lot of clubs doing now is they're maybe aware of XG and some basic stats, you know, like, okay, on base percentage is more important than batting average in baseball, right? So I think that's kind of where we're at in a lot of the football clubs. And then they're still using that to kind of supplement what they're already doing, which is scouting and maybe they're using stats to screen, you know, to whittle down their universe of players and scouting. And then they're doing the video analysis and then trying to, you know, supplement their video analysis with some of this analytics. And they're being reactive to the culture that exists already, mm-hmm. that is very much coaching driven, very much tactics driven, and kind of legacy old school driven. And where you see the clubs that have really embraced this, they've flipped that pyramid. And you see somebody like Klopp, who, by all accounts, has completely bought in and has been convinced that this is an empowerment tool, right? This isn't something to belittle his role at the club. It's like, holy crap, I have a theoretical physicist telling me how to play, you know, football better, yeah. and I'm going to get a competitive advantage against a club that's got supposedly the best manager in the world, who has the biggest budget in the world and the best players, and, you know, we're going to win the league by 20 points, well, or whatever it ended up being. That's, I would argue, a lot of that has to do with what Liverpool has adopted in the advanced analytics space, and that comes from Fenway Marketing Group or Management Group, which owns the Red Sox, which obviously baseball being on the forefront of this, you know, you can connect the dots pretty quick. And as you look across European football, you know, understandably, a lot of these clubs keep tight-lipped on some of this stuff. But if you just read press clippings on some of them, you can kind of pick out the ones that are doing different things, that are getting competitive advantages doing some of this stuff. And they start to stick out like sore thumbs because you're like, well, holy crap, how are they doing so well in Serie A or in, you know, in La Liga? And, you know, or how is this team competing in Europe all of a sudden? Like they came from nowhere. Well, yeah, once in a while you have a great generation. You know, sometimes you have aberrations historically, like the Lisbon Lions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it starts to pop up in multiple places at the same time, and you have this transcendent switch in technology merging with big data, well, again, I don't know for sure what's happening, but given my background and my life experience, they kind of stick out like sore thumbs. So I'm guessing. I think a reasonably educated guess that that's who's adopting. So.
And so you mentioned there, obviously, Liverpool, and I think one of the challenges, forgive me if I'm wrong, but the whole sort of Moneyball thing in baseball started with not a successful side.
Yeah, it's you know, as with a lot of things, when you get into a competitive landscape, it's Darwinism, right? Darwinism, I should say.
Yeah.
The A's had a low budget, so they had, you know, they were trying to figure out how to compete with a low budget. You know, you look at the Yankees, who were very slow at adopting Moneyball, let's call it that. Mm-hmm. And again, I like Moneyball is still kind of the, you know, the easy way to reference this, but I think it's also dangerous to reference it as Moneyball because, like I said, Moneyball wasn't theoretical physicists building machine learning models.
Yeah.
Right. So we're multiple generations.
Yeah, Moneyball was just the initial basic concept that it's massively evolved from. Yeah.
Right. And, we eventually flew to the moon. Right. So, you know, Newton figured out gravity and that was a big deal. But then, you know, you kind of have to build on top of that. Right. So Moneyball is kind of like the beginning of this. And we're now going down this realm of a lot more data, a lot more advanced analytics. But the Yankees were slow to, you know, to on the uptake. And I would argue it's not a coincidence. By far the richest club in MLB, they've only won one World Series in the last 20 years.
I'm just wondering if the challenge here is, because what a lot of this is doing, that particularly if you look at Scottish football, and football in general, and use Liverpool as an example, the challenge here is there is an accepted way of doing it. There is get some guys in who know the game, who learn the game, and it's a risk for the established elite team.
Absolutely.
To then say, well, we're going to ditch the way that everybody's done it forever and go with this new route. And so what you've seen then is, in Germany, where they're keener to adopt new ideas, is my perception. You've got this crop of... I'm too lazy to analyse the data. So I like reading people who do. So read the numbers game, read Soconomics, as people in here will know many times. You know, a book I love is Factfulness. I love reading stuff about data and facts that leads me to stuff. And the challenge for football is to say, right, we're going to turn everything on our head. The way we've been doing it for years, we're going to do the complete opposite. It takes a brave team to do that. Manchester United don't do it, and they drop down. Liverpool hadn't won the title for 16, 17 years, so they've got nothing to lose. So Liverpool adopt it.
Well, and that's you make a great point, and I think I just read an article in The Athletic last week about Barcelona and the debacle that they've had in the transfer market the last few years, and how they expended all of these resources to hire data scientists and, you know, to embrace big data, and then the people at the top of the club basically ignored all of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I come back to this idea of inverting the pyramid, right? So you have to have full buy-in and to understand that this is really at the center. You know, the club should be using big data for marketing purposes. They should be using it to get better sponsors. They should be doing it to, I joke, my wife's a physician, and, you know, one of the hot areas in there for machine learning is radiologists, right? So they come up with algorithms to read the scans that you have taken of your or whatever ailment that you have. They now are applying machine learning to try and detect stuff, and they have a better rate of accuracy than human radiologists do. Mm-hmm. In some of the stuff that they're developing. Well, I think maybe that could help a football club, the same kind of thing, right? I'm not talking about me. I'm just saying generally, you can get some of the best analysts in the world, and they're not going to be as good as some of these algorithms that have been developed, because they're dealing. We can't crunch the data. You can't take 100 million bits of data, and the human mind can't process that. So it's really not only saying, you know, because you get to your point, you get these established entrenched institutions and, you know, people that run some of these, that a lot of these ideas are new, right? So they don't necessarily understand them. You know, for example, I've heard about this artificial intelligence, you know, I'm a Fortune 500 technology company. I have no idea what it even means, but go buy me one of those and add it to my portfolio of companies.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So just the idea of recognizing that it exists is one thing, but then actually embracing it culturally and making it the focal point and understanding the power of all this and have full institutional buy-in, I think that's going to have to happen. And again, we've seen this in U.S. sports, right? I live near Baltimore. I live about an hour and a half from Baltimore, and my best friend, my daughter's godfather, is a Baltimore fan. He's an Orioles fan, right? Well, they just stole an executive from the Astros, those cheating scumbag Astros. Excuse my, that's my baseball fan coming out of me. They stole one of their leading front office people because they had been owned by this guy, Peter Angelos, who basically flew by the seat of his pants for the entire time that he owned the team. And at times they were okay, and at times they were really good and made the playoffs. And eventually it all came crumbling down. Their farm system was terrible. They've been doing a lot of the old stuff that just didn't work. And eventually the hollowing out of the organization from a competitive standpoint is all of the teams around them were adopting these methods, right? Following the A's, following Tampa, even the Yankees. And that's why the Dodgers and the Yankees now are true powerhouses. And they've been so good the last few years is because they married, you know, they stole the best people from those smaller clubs. Mm-hmm. Sound familiar? Right? Stole them over, you know, paid them to come work for them, gave them these huge budgets to be able to buy the best players, but not only the best players, but using, you know, the big data and the analytics to figure out who they actually are and how to use them. Right? So Barcelona thinks they're buying the best players, right? But is it really the best players for how they're going to play, for the people they already have, or is it a name thing? You know, they have a brand. This guy, you know, he's one of the best players in world football. He's a Galactico, so we should go buy him, right? That's the old way of doing it. That's mm-hmm. signing A-Rod for $300 million when he's, you know, coming off steroids and getting washed up, like the Yankees did, right? So that's the old way. The new way is, okay, does it make sense to pay a 33-year-old $40 million a year when he's starting to fall off a cliff physically? And oh, by the way, if he's not taking PEDs anymore, that's going to be even worse. So, and that's leading to labor strife. I mean, baseball, it used to be that you got to 30, you became a free agent, and you cashed in. You know, mm-hmm. that's you didn't make a lot when you were younger in baseball, and you cashed in. Well, now there's a huge labor problem because the collective bargaining agreement was based off of that economic model. And then all the teams figured out, well, that's a dumb idea. Why am I playing these old guys who aren't any good anymore? Huge contracts into their later years. I'm going to play the guy who's 25 that's better.
Yep.
And pay him $500,000, right? So, you know, those are all very simple, easy concepts that, you know, have been proven for 20 years now in baseball. And a lot of them apply just athletically, right? It's not a baseball thing. Mm-hmm. Skills are different. The game's different. But hockey's taken it up. Basketball's taken it up. You know, the forerunners in football are taking it up. So, again, back to my horrible analogy, it's like, okay, is the earth flat or isn't it? And you know, once you've decided that it's not, build towards the future recognizing that. And how do you actually deal with the reality of the world that you're living in? And I think, you know, the existential risk to teams now is, where are you at in that food chain, right? Are you an early adopter? Are you going to be a middle adopter? And, you know, God help you if you're a late adopter, if you don't have the resources to play catch up.
Yeah.
And that's where you get into this idea of benchmarking, you know, like a club like Celtic, like who's Celtic's peer group, right? So this comes back to analytics. One of the things I don't see a lot in the analytics space in Scottish football is creating legitimate benchmarks. Mm-hmm. Right? I talked to a software vendor this past week, one of the big vendors in football statistics, and I was talking to this guy about benchmarking. I was like, well, how can I build a benchmark in your software? Can't do it. Right? Can't do it. I'm like, well, you know, I said to him, that's a big deal. And he said, well, the clubs that are interested in that do it themselves. And I said, well, what about the thousands of clubs globally that don't have the resources to be hiring, you know, an MIT or an Oxford trained theoretical physicist and mathematician PhD and an army of people to build this stuff? I go, well, you know, what's the lower leagues going to do? Are they just not going to care about this stuff? You know, don't you want to give them the resources to be able to do this with your software? Yeah. And so they have, you know, they were one of the early movers into that space. And to your point, you know, they're complacent because they have a nice business. They're doing very well. If someone's interested in that, they'll go do it themselves. And it'll be some startup or some other firm, maybe, or maybe it's somebody inside that fights the internal politics and the risk aversion, or the leadership says, oh wow, we do need to do this kind of stuff, that will, you know, bring that to the marketplace. But that's, again, in baseball, that's benchmarking is analytics in baseball. Like your peer group at the position level, the position group. I mean, how do you know what you're doing is good or not if you're not comparing it to something that's relevant? I mean, it's such a simple concept in analytics. And, you know, again, it's back to this, it's not complicated to recognize easy concepts, but if they're against entrenched beliefs, then that's where you enter into the challenges.
Yeah, I'll maybe speak to you later about the benchmark issue. But for me, I think the sort of holy grail of the data for me that I have thought about and latched onto is very simplistically, from a very simple level, we all know that players, as you talked about, you know, they start to improve, and they go up, then they plateau, and then they fall off. And for me, the opening door as to why football clubs need data and is when you know they're going over the other side of the cliff. And you know that they're going the other side of that plateau after they've gone. Because the issue is the old-fashioned way of doing it. The first game or two, a player doesn't, you know, like my boxing, and they always say that the reason, I remember it was David Hay was talking, and he said, problem with being a boxer is the day you know that you've gone over the hill, you're in the ring and somebody hits you and you don't get out of the way. That's the day you know. You've seen it we've seen it for decades, the fighter who has one fight too many because he finds out in the ring. And for me, the magic of data is players can have an off day and you don't want to make a judgment too early. So the old fashioned way of doing it, it was a year, 18 months after the player was well on his way down the curve that people would start to say, do you know what? I think he's past it. And one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast is some of the most recent stuff you've had on, and some of it in particular following last podcast I had with Lawrence Donegan on the podcast, when we were just talking about players and specifically Scott Brown. So I'm going to start moving to talk about our squad otherwise, because we could be here all night talking about data, and I think maybe I have you on more than once. If we talk about the Celtic squad, and I made the comment, having done the 9 in a row podcasts of Celtic, that easy with hindsight, and that there was 2 or 3 phases of that Lisbon Lions team where you would have got, there was some players you would have got rid of 3-4 months before Jock Stein did, or a season before Jock Stein did, and there was other players that you maybe got rid of too quickly. And Alex Ferguson, I think, was a massive adopter of, and Alex Ferguson says he learned a lot from Jock Stein about needing to be ruthless as a manager. And he was a real big one for getting rid of players that people couldn't understand. And then when the guy was at the next club, it was fairly clear why. And again, I think it's Soccernomics that Alex Ferguson talks about. The only player he regrets getting rid of too early was Jaap Stam, because he was looking at there would have been very basic statistics and data about Jaap Stam's tackles, and they were going down. But what he only realised when Jaap Stam went on and he saw him playing for Lazio was that's because Jaap Stam's experience meant he was no longer needing to make those tackles because he was intercepting it. And so my gut feel is that's a mistake due to insufficient data rather than the data giving him the wrong thing. So I have made the passing comment that nothing that I've seen in him play, but based on having done the 9 in a row podcast and the Lisbon Lions team, Scott Brown would play about 10-15 games for us this season. Since then, I have been looking at your data, and it is pretty much saying that Scott Brown shouldn't play that many games for Celtic this season.
Yeah, so again, this is where you get back to the idea of being a fan versus being an analyst a sport versus an entertainment business.
Yeah.
Right. So as a fan, I mean, as a Celtics supporter, who doesn't love Scott Brown? I mean, you have to be a...
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't saying that in terms of I didn't want Scott Brown to be playing for Celtic. It was, yeah, if I was to be completely cold, take a step back, look at our experience of the last time we were doing nine in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, as I, when I knew I was coming on, I thought about how to maybe approach this, because it's a delicate subject. You know, this is ripe for cognitive dissonance, right? This is ripe. People don't want to see their heroes age. Right, people didn't want to watch Muhammad Ali fight Larry Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, people didn't want to watch Willie Mays play for the Mets, or for Michael Jordan to play for the Wizards.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you know, ultra competitive athletes are oftentimes the last. That's what makes the ones that do retire young stick out so much. You know, in the U.S., Jim Brown, who was you know a great tailback for the Cleveland Browns, retired in I think it was the early '60s. You know, one of the greatest athletes ever. And he just played 9 years. I was like, that's it. I'm tired of getting beat up, right? And he went and became an actor, right? So that's the rare one. Usually they hang on too long because they're ultra competitive.
Yeah.
It had, you know. So if they're not managed, of course they're always going to say that they're ready to go. I mean, they're competitive. I was playing baseball until last summer. I'll be 45 next month, and I was playing with a torn labrum and playing with guys you know 15 years younger than me that. Played in college and minor league baseball, and I was still hobbling out there, probably 30 pounds overweight. Right, I had no business being out there, but I loved the competition and I wanted to keep going. So it's that's normal. The question is, how do you manage it? What are the expectations? Right, and that was the main catalyst that thrust me in to start delving into data, is because I saw what was going on. I was actually a huge advocate of Neil Lennon getting hired. I was out on the island, right, with a few of us back in May when the appointment in the shower happened, largely because of your podcast, actually, about what had happened the prior summer with Rogers. To me, it made sense that the board needed someone that they could trust based off of the baggage from that,
mm-hmm.
and that was ultimately the most important thing for the transfer market, right? They weren't going to back someone unless they trusted them. So I thought, Lennon, they're going to trust them. They're going to back them. Lennon has a great, a really good track record in the transfer market.
Mm-hmm.
So I was all in. I was like, this would be a good combination. And then Lennon said he's going to build the team around Brown. And I was like, well, maybe that's just a rhetorical thing. Maybe that's, you know, he's the captain. That makes sense. And then he just started playing every game. And he started playing injured, which I think most people don't remember, which is he was hurt for that Cluj game. Right. This goes back to cognitive dissonance. People still remember that game as the game that McGregor played left back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When I've analyzed that game heavily, I remember it as the game that Brown was absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
And because he was hurt, we didn't know at the time, but Lennon subsequently admitted that he was playing, I think, bad toes at the time. Right. So you have a 34-year-old midfielder who we know based off of science. Right. This isn't. These aging curves are scientific, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get older, we slow down. And Brown probably jumped his curve, right? He adjusted his curve when he changed his lifestyle reportedly when Rogers came in.
Yep.
Right? So you can delay. He hopped the curve. On the path he was on, he would have declined faster probably. But we all declined. Jordan got slower. Ali got slower. Everyone gets slower,
mm-hmm.
right? Unless you take PEDs. And... You know, so he has begun to slow, and that is there in the data if you look for it. And you know, if you just look at interceptions, you just look at ball recovery, some of the things that people will look at. And that's why I was talking about data analytics is going to transcend, right? So what we're going to have, some clubs have already started to do it. They're adopting technology like optical motion capture cameras, which again they've been doing in baseball for years now. So they're going to have sprint speeds of all of their players. So they're going to know how fast every one of their players is running. Their average sprint speed, all of that is going to be captured, right? How hard is Scott Brown kicking the ball relative to what he did 3 years ago? They're going to know all of that data, right? So you're going to be able to model these declines much more than they do now. But it's, you know, the other part of that is, and I'm not opposed to having a warrior central midfielder, a defensive midfielder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I I always use these analogies because I think they help introduce the concept the first time. So if you look, people that watch The Last Dance, the Bulls documentary, yep. right? So they didn't know at the time, but post hoc, people have gone back and done statistical analysis of that Bulls team with Rodman. And what Rodman did, because of his defensiveness, he actually increased the offensive efficiency of the Bulls.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's counterintuitive. You wouldn't normally say, well, we're going to replace one of our better offensive players with this guy who hardly ever shoots, and all he does is play defense and rebound, and think that's going to make our offense better. But it did.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm not opposed to that conceptually, but the issue is, if you benchmark Brown now, he's not an elite defensive midfielder anymore. The physicality is declining, naturally. I mean, he's clearly still in great shape, but again, Father Time spares no one. So he's not getting around. The volume of his activities, particularly in Europe, is declined on a very normal aging curve, to the point this was specifically engineered for. I will admit to enjoying triggering some cognitive dissonance in people once in a time, give them a nice wind up. My mother is Glaswegian, so I like to mess around with people a little bit. And you know, when I put out a tweet basically comparing Brown in Europe this year to Ryan Jack statistically, like that was for a reason. You know, do you consider Ryan Jack an elite defensive European level midfielder? And I don't think he is. There might be some Rangers supporters that do, because they hallucinate.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Brown used to be that. He used to be so mobile and explosive, and his tackling was elite, that carrying someone like him in your midfield, where he doesn't really do much offensively directly, right? He's not creative.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's something that's coming out now in analytics, is the importance of that midfield creativity, the importance of scoring goals and having people like an Encham, like a McGregor, that move the ball and break lines. And Brown doesn't really offer any of that. So if you're going to have a player like that in your midfield, they need to be an elite defensive midfielder. They need to be a Wanyama. They need to be a 28-year-old Scott Brown. And he's not that anymore. So, you know, I don't think it's a surprise that we've, in the last 2 years in particular, basically when we've played Rangers or anyone better, we've had issues in the midfield. And we, you know, almost feels like we're getting overrun a lot.
Mm-hmm.
People always say, oh, it's because tactics are wrong, or, you know, ultimately, I mean, to me, it was amazing to watch that PSG game, and how athletic our midfield was, and how much we got around, right? And how much different that looks. And I tweeted some screenshots about Soro's passing,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you mix athleticism with passing, I mean, that's when you start getting, like, that's the total value of a player. It's both sides, defensively, creativity, right? Athleticism. And you know, I'm not saying Soro's ready to be the starter or anything, but it's stark when you see that athleticism and then you compare it to someone who doesn't have that anymore. And you know, the pushback I always get is the intangibles, the leadership. Fair enough, right? You can't quantify those directly,
mm-hmm.
right? Us data geeks can't quantify that. But you can benchmark certain things, and you can look at the times that Brown's been in the side versus the times he hasn't. You can look at and see that in comparable games where you've had McGregor playing that role, is he as physical as Brown? No. Is he as good of a tackler as Brown? No. But he's more mobile. He's more creative. And the team, I've looked at the data. The team defense of him with Christie at an 8, the times that it's been there, which has not been often, amazingly. So the sample size isn't huge, but the defense has been scary. Like, you know, completely died. That game, I watched that game from February against the 3-1 against Kilmarnock in February when Brown was out. I think it was in between the Copenhagen games when he picked up something. And go watch that game again, or watch the December 18 game against Dundee. It's frightening. It's frightening, the pressure, the unrelenting pressure that took place in those games, the control of possession, the movement, the passing, the chance creation. I mean, it's frightening. And to me, that's what we should be domestically, mm-hmm. like 9 out of 10 games. Right? We should be absolutely dominating teams to the point of it's frightening, given the disparity in talent that we have. And too often, I just don't think we do. If you think about it, if we're playing against your average bottom six team, I mean, Brown serves as a it's like we're playing a man down mm-hmm. offensively, right? And sure, he'll intercept some and he'll recover some loose balls, not as many as he used to in open space. Because again, that's back to this issue of decline. Like mentally, he's obviously still there. His instincts are incredible. I mean, that's partly what made him great. Mm-hmm. And his instincts are still great. He just doesn't get to as many. And there's no shame in that. There's no dishonor in that. It's just the reality. And a McGregor that is 80% as good defensively as Brown is now, this Brown, but way better offensively, to me, particularly against 10 out of 11 SPFL opponents, it really shouldn't even be a discussion.
I like data is I sometimes feel fans are more likely to criticise a player who nearly gets there to a player who's nowhere near there because they can see that the guy was just a foot short from where he should have been.
Yeah.
And if I, in the last 2 or 3 years, I mean, I like Brown, think he's, fantastic leader on the pitch and does have some of those intangible leadership qualities that I think at times is able to lift the players around him. But equally, and again, this is me, as I said earlier, if I was ever in charge of an organisation, somebody else does the data for me and I look at it afterwards. I'm too lazy to analyse it myself, but I love getting the data through. But I love getting it with context. You need to always have context, getting back to your benchmarking thing. But if I think back anecdotally to game goals we've lost in major games, I can think of a number of times where the ball is cut back to a midfielder of the opposition at the edge of our box to score. And the thing I always think, where are our two defensive midfield players? Because that's where they should be. Because the defence is somewhere between the penalty spot and the 6-yard box because they're running back, facing back goal. So the defensive midfielders are there. And then also, on the same thing, I had a conversation with somebody earlier today about the dilemma. Lots of football people don't like 3-5-2.
Yep.
And obviously some version of 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1 or whatever. But basically, when playing at a more elite level, we will 3-5-2, we would probably get ripped to shreds playing European football.
Yep.
But domestically, playing a 4-2-3-1, for me, against the bottom six teams, having six defensive players when you've got 4-2-3-1.
Yep.
It just seems a waste. And one of the things I thought was interesting was one of your comments during the friendlies where, I can't remember, maybe in the Lyon game. Was it the Lyon game where we played 60 minutes with the fringe players and 30 minutes or 20 minutes with the, I think it was 65 minutes or 70 minutes or something with the fringe players and 20, 25 minutes with the what looks like Lennon's preferred first 11. And I was watching that and immediately felt that everything clicked into place the minute the first 11 came on. The team looked like it was playing in formation, yet you tweeted that despite people saying that, the stats didn't back that up. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, so that comes into some stuff I think I've observed that isn't related to Brown. I think he contributes to it, but so, and again, I'm far from any kind of tactical expert. but to me, it's common sense that you need people, you know, and this is, again, this idea of XG being, just the concept of XG being a transformative, you know, money ball concept, which is, it's better to be closer and center in front of the goal. You score more if you shoot from there, right? Common sense. Now you think about it, right? But the, to quantify that and say, okay, if you're in this space, you have a 20 times greater chance of scoring than Encham and Christie both playing a 10 and shooting an ungodly amount, too many, and they're both bad at it from outside the box, right? So the idea that you need to have players around the six-yard box central to score reliably to create good chances is not earth-shattering. Well, what's earth-shattering is that when we play certain formations with Edouard as our striker, we rarely have people in those positions. Not local, meaning that they may end up getting there. Edouard may end up getting there because he picks up the ball on the left side outside the 18, beats four guys, or passes off and dishes to someone, right? So that's what, to me, that's why I advocated it back in January about why I thought he needed a strike partner, because if you look at where he tends to go, he's very much like El Yunisi, and that's why I'm not a huge fan of them playing together, particularly in Europe, is not the way they're being used right now, is that they tend to occupy similar space, and they tend to leave the right side not empty, but you end up collapsing. So what oftentimes happens is you get Christie then collapsing towards the left, you get Forrest collapsing towards the middle of the box, and you've got the deficit of Brown's lack of creativity on the right, right? So I had documented this sometime in the spring where I went back and I analyzed all of the games that Celtic had played against Rangers or better teams. So basically like European games against better, you know, not the Minnows in July, but decent quality, you know, kind of Cluj and higher. And our offensive output, if you look at XG, was heavily tilted to the left, right? And if you look at teams that I think do more analytics, they basically shut us down on the right, and Rangers have shut us down. And that's, you know, I don't want to get it too much. In the war of tactics and analytics, my fear is we might be losing right now on that front relative to Rangers. And the system that they've built, to me, seems pretty effective to close the talent gap that they have against teams like us and the other better teams that they're facing in the Europa League. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? I mean, they've basically played us to a draw over the last two seasons with 70% of our budget of wages. I know that's not popular to say. I know everyone's going to be screaming by listening to this, right? But that's the fact. When you look at XG differentials, that includes the last year under Rodgers, the hybrid year, when, I mean, they were playing players that were legitimately not, you know, at Europa League level on that side. And yet they still played us to almost a draw that year, if you add up all the kind of the XG. So, you know, I think that there are some basic things that could be done. That's why I see these rumors of a Jetty, whether it was Sean Weissman, some of these other more traditional strikers. I think Griffiths played that role to a degree, and that's, I think, why that partnership clicked so much. I'm not sure how much of that was specifically Griffiths and how much it was just we had someone over there. I mean, Griffiths is good, don't get me wrong. But I'm not sure if we didn't put any of these other guys in that position. I mean, Edouard is that good. He's that far above level where he's playing right now. I mean, I put in different pieces before. You know, when he was playing in that 3-5-2 with a strike partner, he was putting up numbers that were that of an elite striker and an elite number 10 at the same time. That's Messi level. Now, that's obviously... he's not Messi. He's competing in the SPFL. Our strength of schedule wasn't huge during that period of time. But he didn't do that in the first half of the season against the same teams, right? And so that's why I get back to this idea. You know, when you start seeing things that make sense and the data confirms it, and then you start getting a sample size, it seems to be enough of there to be some efficacy. And again, to his credit, maybe that's why they're looking at a Jetty. Maybe they've been 4-2-3-1. because they don't like the partnership that without Griffiths that you know, one of the other strikers would play with Edouard.
Mm-hmm.
But that, this goes back to this idea of risk, and I've been on this warpath for a couple months now. Is I see, you know, one of the things that I'm good at in my career and my training and looking at risk, thinking about risk three-dimensionally, and growing risks, and risks typically grow exponentially while everything looks fine, and then all of a sudden, you know what hits the fan.
Yeah.
Right. So risk gets realized fast. So we have a cocktail of factors coming up in the next 6 weeks, which pile on risk to a degree that I think is very dangerous for the team heading into trying to secure 10 in a row. We've got these three fixtures in Champions League qualifying. Theoretically, all three of them could be on the road. We just don't know. Right. They're basically single game knockout. And mm-hmm. I tweeted this the other day. If you look at the XG from the Sarajevo game, it was basically it was a push. We happened to win 3-1. But again, you get in that kind of knockout, there's a red card. You know, somebody pulls up lame after you have your third sub. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. This is this idea of risk, of robustness, right? So is the system or is the situation robust? And I see a lot of factors lining up that if we don't qualify, this was your podcast recently, when you mentioned hearing about Edouard, basically we need to make Champions League for him to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wouldn't be shocked to hear that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, for this to come down to three games for him to stick around in knockout games, if you're not addressing the famed defense secretary of the United States once said, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, you have known unknowns and you have unknown unknowns, right? So we have a known unknown if we're playing a 35-year-old midfielder in Europe against better sides, right? God forbid he gets played when he's hurt,
mm-hmm.
like we saw several times, including the loss to Cluj I mentioned earlier, the loss to Copenhagen, he played hurt again. Right? I just, again, I can't fathom that. That, to me, makes no sense. An injured 35-year-old, or at that time 34, how do you justify that? Like, there's not enough leadership in Genghis Khan could not have overcome that challenge, right? So, the margin for error here of making unforced errors that we shouldn't be doing, and with the potential risk of losing an Edouard, maybe an Ayer, maybe an Encham, right? Outside of Morelos, it doesn't look like Rangers are probably going to lose much, right? They might still add more. I mean, I would think they're going to probably replace Morelos with something. I mean, who knows if it'll be as good. So you start lining up how this could go sideways very fast if we just lose one game or if we lose the knockout tie to get into the Champions League. And that scares me. The other thing that scares me goes, and I'll circle back to the last dance analogy, is if for people that are listening that weren't NBA fans of the era. So the 1980s was like this wheeling, dealing glory days of the NBA. Fast basketball, fast break, prime time, Magic, Bird with the Celtics. And then the 90s hit, and they mentioned it in the documentary, the Jordan rules that the Pistons put in place, where they basically just assaulted the man.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that was the Jordan rules. We're going to not play basketball. We're going to wrestle. Well, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be surprised heading into this SPFL season, given the financial constraints that teams are going to be under, if the officiating gets a little more lax.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly against Rangers and Celtic. And of course, all the Celtic fans will say it's a conspiracy about the Masons. And, the Rangers will all say it's a conspiracy some other way. Doncaster's doing something again. But, the likelihood is it's just going to be, okay, we're trying to make this a little more competitive because these other teams are having issues fielding better teams. The NBA did that.
You wouldn't
the NBA did that in the 90s. I'm sorry. If you look at those games in the 90s,
uh-huh.
lot of those Bulls wins, you're like, oh, they beat someone in the conference finals or in the NBA finals. It's like 82-78, right? I remember it. I actually stopped watching basketball intently because it was not good basketball. It was all fouls and like a wrestling match half the time. So could I see that happening this season in Scottish football? That wouldn't shock me at all. If all of a sudden the refereeing gets more lax and they're allowing assaults to occur, which, I mean, we just saw some of that in the friendlies the last couple of days, right?
Where guys there's no fan pressure either to put external pressure on officials. So really only will be the players on the park that would, you know, so again, you're not going to have that mounting, that's the fifth challenge in a row you've missed that the fans put on officials. So,
well, that, and so there we get back to this issue of injury risk, rotation, right? Given the clogging of fixtures, I'm just talking about risks in general now.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the thing about risks. You can try to be good at risk planning. You got to think about things that might not happen. Right. And then you get called a jerk if they don't happen. Right. But that's the job of someone that's thinking about risk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So to me, if Celtic are going to if they're going to use the squad like they did last year, I mean, for Brown to have played 4,000 some minutes last year. Right. I get back to this. It's if Brown's so important and he needs to play every game, he can't play every game.
Yeah.
Right. It's not the leadership and the intangibles are that important. He should not be playing every game. It shouldn't have been happening at age 33. Shouldn't have been happening at age 34. So you're risking a major long-term injury to him by overusing him, right? Same with McGregor. Same with any of these players, right? So if we're heading into a season where the league's going to turn into, and I'm not saying it is, but again, I could see it happening, right? And do I have confidence that our management team is not going to play injured players after last season? With El Yunisi playing in the cup final and Brown basically limping around in the Cluj game, the semifinal against Hibs, he was hurt and played, right? Where they said he wasn't going to play on the Friday and then he played. That's my favorite one because that's a perfect example of data analytics and people just completely ignoring it, right? Because Brown scored two goals that game. Right, it's like the Hamilton game. That's the other one, the home one where he scored the winner.
Yeah,
right. Those are my two favorites of the year. Right, so the Hibs game, he was objectively bad that day. Like if you look at his volume stats, like he was clearly hurt. Right, so fair enough. I mean, the guy's hurt. He can't run. I mean, he's out there limping around, and so of course his volume of passes was way down, and he happened to score two goals. One was on a deflection on a corner. And the other one was because he got hit in the face or something, so he didn't run back. And then there was a counterattack with him and El Yunisi, and he ended up getting a rebound and scoring. And it's like, okay, well, he was in the right place at the right time, but was that really because of his leadership or, you know, he should have been playing hurt? And the Hibs one, it was like, we beat Hibs 2-1 at home, and the amount of chances we created that day was pretty low. I think our XG was like 2-something. You know, not great for a home game against Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, sure, he absolutely deserves credit for scoring that goal. There's no question he pushes the team on. But I'd rather have McGregor play that day and us win 5-0 than have that wonderful feeling of an unnecessarily close game that Brown wins on a last-minute goal. And that's, I think, the difference here, right? People will remember that memory and love it and cherish it and fair play. Everyone loved it in the moment. I mean, it was tremendous. And it was the type of thing that a true captain does. I mean, it was. It encapsulated everything that Brown is. And it's wonderful. I would argue you still shouldn't have played that day.
It's interesting because that day I was getting increasingly annoyed during the game because of the lack of creativity in the team. And that we were clearly dominant in terms of ball possession, but Hamilton were coming back into the game, and then when I went crazy when Hamilton equalised because Stevie Wonder could see the Hamilton equaliser coming for the previous 15 minutes,
right?
And And then I'm going mental. We take kickoff, go at the park, Brown scores. And the people round about me are turning around saying, see, look, they're looking at it from the perspective of, see, the captain drove us through and got it. I'm looking at the perspective of, but we should have been we should have been playing differently, had different personnel in the park, and been 3-4 nil up. And Hamilton wouldn't have equalised, or if Hamilton scored a consolation goal because we switched off with 2 minutes to go, it wouldn't have been the end of the world. It shouldn't. Your point, the Brown goal, yes, was testament to Brown, and this is not a, you know, I don't want people listening to this thinking this is a, I got you on to give Brown a verbal kicking. This is not about Brown per se. This is about the errors that I saw when I was recording the 9 in a row podcasts of holding on to players because your emotions don't let you see the reality of the incremental decline in that player. That's what this.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, if I diverge into more traditional paranoia of being a supporter and a fan here, right? So if I'm hallucinating my own theories instead of actually having any data on this, I mean, I think Lennon's relationship with Brown is ripe for cognitive dissonance.
Yep.
Right? I mean, Lennon basically could easily see himself in Brown, mm-hmm. right? And go back and watch late Lennon at Celtic. I watched, I forget which game it was. It was obviously the Martin O'Neill year. It was like 01 or 02 against Rangers. I forget which game it was. I watched most of the game during the lockdown, like when we're all starving for anything to watch. And I forget which game it was, but I was watching Lennon and I was like, man, he's already lost a few steps. And that was 01 or 02.
Mm-hmm.
And how many more years did he play? Like 3 or 4?
Yeah, 4 or 5 even.
Right. But yeah, depending on if you're starting at 1 or 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, so by the end of it, oofa, you know, to use a technical term. So, you know, is absolutely, and I don't blame Brown in any of this. He's doing everything he can. He's scratching and clawing because he's the ultimate competitor. He's the ultimate leader. He's the guy that wants to command his troops into battle, right? To use the horrible, tired cliches of equating sports to military, right? I mean, that's what he wants to do. He's an alpha. That's what he is built to do. It's not going to come from him. Like, I would totally respect him if he said, went to Lennon and said, you know what? I think we're a better team if McGregor plays. Do you really think a competitor of his ilk would ever do that? I would be shocked.
Yeah.
Right. So it's going to have to come from someone else. And, you know, who is that? You know, I would assume Lennon. But again, I as an outsider, I have no idea how the club's running, how, you know, what the relationship between Kennedy and Lennon is, who's actually doing the tactics. I mean, some of the stuff you hear about Lennon talking about, he's more of a Martin O'Neill guy and maybe Kennedy's handling the tactics more so. But I don't know. And this comes back to this issue of the culture of analytics. You get, you know, people are conditioned. You know, if I'm a 23-year-old doing analytics at Celtic, I might be the greatest data scientist. I might be able to do unbelievable stuff when I'm told to. But am I going to get data and take it to the head guy and say, yeah, geez, you know, something's wrong here. What are we doing? You know, is that really something? I don't know what the internal culture is, but given the stature of Scott Brown inside the club, I could see that being a really hard conversation for, you know, most of the analysts that are employed within any club, let alone Celtic, and the stature of someone like Brown. I mean, imagine, you know, really any great player, any great hero at any professional sports team. And having some nerd who doesn't know anything about, you know, football saying some spreadsheet you know.
You referenced The Last Dance there, and the whole premise on The Last Dance was somebody in the non-basketball part of the club, of the franchise, as they kept using the term. And obviously the data they had was nowhere near what we're like talking about Celtic should have, but was taking the principle of this is an ageing team.
Yep.
And I'm going to get rid of it before and try and evolve it. And obviously they did it wrong, but the principle of what they were trying to achieve was I need to transition from that elite team to the next elite team. And I would like, you see, part of me would like to think Brown will have the self-belief in himself, but will equally be smart enough to understand he's 35 years of age and cannot possibly be the Scott Brown at 29 and 30 or 28.
Well, so that's where I've actually been even more discouraged, if that's possible. So, if you look at his usage in the 4-2-3-1, he, you know, I, and again, this is me surmising, so I don't know this, but when I look at the data, I see a story develop under Rodgers, which is the first season he comes in, starts doing his thing in the during the qualifiers, but even at the time, he said, we don't have time to put anything in. We got to get ready to try and qualify for the Champions League. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really have a full preseason, put in the Rodgers way that first season. It was more of a fly by the seat of the pants, I think. And if you look at the data, Brown is kind of a hybrid of his last year with Dyla. So his volume stats are still good, right? Mm-hmm. But you start to see more of the influence of Rodgers. The next season, he totally changed how he used Brown. That's when Brown became the central, mostly six sitting right in front of the back four, mm-hmm. the two center backs, and directing play, and passing endlessly sideways, as the Rodgers detractors would say, or backwards, right? But he was the quintessential defensive midfielder, breaking up play, winning loose balls, and recycling and keeping possession, right? Made total sense. His pressing under Rodgers was not nearly as aggressive, right? So if you look at his last year under Dyla, he just wasn't as much going into the opposing team's half or into the final third. Well, we've gone back in time now, this last 12 months under Lennon. So when he's being used in the 4-2-3-1 in particular, you'll frequently see Brown up in the final third of the opposing team. And again, I've documented this a lot of times with screenshots and one of the big problems we've had against better teams is defensive transition. So I don't understand why we have our slowest midfielder, as smart as he is at anticipating, but he can't chase down little water bug guys anymore, right? I mean, he gets blown by pretty frequently, and that's because he's slowed down, and that's just reality, and he. For him to be chasing back and trying to get back after he gets passed around, I just don't understand it. That's in his data. So this goes back to this idea of analytics, right? So I looked at the data, didn't make sense. It was a flag. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why are we using him to press more? So then I went and I looked at the video. And then I looked at situations where clearly he's too far extended. He's having trouble getting back. That leaves our midfield wide open. And 9 times out of 10 domestically, we get away with it because our center backs are so good relative to level. And McGregor is so good at anticipating and getting back that, those issues are covered up. But when we start playing better teams, as we saw with Copenhagen in that horrible loss mm-hmm. at home, 3 opportunities, 3 goals. And you get into those situations that, teams that are better are more clinical and they'll make you pay. And that's why, like I said, the last 2 seasons in particular, I think we've really had that problem. And that's, again, if you look at aging curves, these are the 2 years, right? So 33, 34, 35, that's when the curve starts to accelerate, right? So, and again, you see it in his data. This is, you know, like I said, this shouldn't be hard, right? This is why I started delving into this, right? Last summer, you know, Alan Morrison, who does Celtic by Numbers, God love him, he puts up with me a little bit. And I started as a reader, love his blog, and I think he does yeoman's work. He's like one of the pioneers on the forefront of this whole thing. He was doing some analysis that he always does. It's great. And I had done my stuff, and I looked at it, and I'm like, man, I think Brown's a really bad matchup for Kluge, because Kluge just loves second balls, chaos in the midfield. And, boy, this is based on the numbers that Alan had shown in decline of Brown. I'm like, man, I just don't think this is a good matchup. And it, you know, turned out not to be. I didn't know he was hurt, obviously. And then really the pushback I got as I started kind of in social media and some of the fan-based media, as I started to voice my opinions. And in the one forum, I actually got called the American who hates Scott Brown. And I was like, okay, well, that, fair enough. But that stoked by, you know, I'm an ultra competitive guy, and that lit the fire in my belly a little bit, and I've been quite insecure in some of my analytics, because, you know, I'm not steeped in Glasgow, I'm not steeped in football, I'm a relative newcomer to this, so that forced me to kind of say, okay, let me dig into this more. And let me really dive into it a little bit. And, you know, again, that's where my background and looking at benchmarking and, you know, I create a whole, and I'm not a data guy. So that's the crazy thing, right? So I have some history with a software firm that did, data management at the institutional enterprise level, but that wasn't me. Like, I worked with the smart people. I wasn't the smart person. So I learned the laws of gravity from them. I certainly didn't calculate it. And, so I understand it, but I don't know how to do it. So I'm a hacker. Like I'm a grinder. Like I'm pulling data out and I'm building my own spreadsheets. So I went through the process. That's that 2 hours in the morning after I have to go pee, Harry. Mm-hmm. That's what I drink my coffee, I go pee, and then I do my 2 hours of spreadsheets.
At least you managed to get to six in the morning.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, you know what? If I'm fair, if I'm honest, it's about 5:45 now. 6 months ago it was 6 o'clock. You know, I put together spreadsheets pulling data down manually from something like Y-Scout. Mm-hmm. I went through all of the group stage teams in Europa League and created my own custom benchmark of defensive midfielders to compare data, right? Because I got called the American who skates, hates Scott Brown. So I got pissed. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do this the right way. Uh-huh. And I spent hours and hours and hours pulling this data down. And it just, I'm like, you know, man. And that's, if you look at Copenhagen, Copenhagen was a perfect example. Zeka, the guy Zeka played their defensive midfield. They had to play a little bit different system. But, you know, he's 31, and he is what Brown was 3 or 4 years ago, only a better passer, right? That, if we're going to compete in Europe, we've got to have European-level players.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, God love him, but now Brown is now a Europa League average defensive midfielder defensively and well below average creatively. So if you balance all that out, what does it equate to? The below average Europa League defensive midfielder. So I indexed that. I benchmarked it. I looked at his percentiles within that group across different categories, and it's like, it stands out. It just does. And yes, he's still great at interceptions. Yes, he's still good at ball recoveries. He's still got tremendous anticipation and the football brain. I mean, that's the wisdom that accrues. That's why guys defer their peak, right? Guys start getting slower at 25, 26. Mm-hmm. Right? They slowly start to get descending down the aging curve physically, but they offset that. Somebody like James Forrest is a good example, right? He's gotten so much better the last 3 or 4 years. Because he's so much smarter. He's just such a good player. I love James. I, he's one of my pet peeves because I hear so much crap about him that's just so provably false. So he's been defying his aging curve physically because he's losing a step, but he's so smart. He's learned so much and he's applying it. But God love him. Next 2 years for a winger, we have to start thinking about James Forrest's usage. And that's the thing with Brown. Like Brown, if he was, you know, maybe 3 inches taller, he could play into his, you know, late 30s in the SPFL as a center back because of how great he is. I mean, do I think he's much slower than Julian? I mean, I don't know, maybe it's maybe a coin toss. I mean, Julian's no, he's not lighting up the stopwatch.
No, so. Julian sometimes looks to me like if you've ever been running along a platform and the train's leaving, and you feel like it's going backwards. That Julian at times has not been the quickest. And Christopher
Eyes. That's why we got him. That's why Christopher Blues, and that's why we paid $7 million for him.
And Christopher Ayer's got a turning circle of an oil tanker, which is the reason why he's a centre half and not a defensive midfield player.
Right, and that's why, and he has 1 foot.
Yeah,
but you're right. So that's you know in and that's the other thing with Brown. Like if you set up profiles of aging curves at different positions, you know strikers can last a little longer because of that relative weight between physical decline and wisdom, let's call it, you know, the cognitive wisdom that accrues as a player ages, there it's like a, you know, for all the economists listening, it's like a supply demand curve, right? You have two curves that intersect, and at some point that really starts to turn into a problem. And you know, in central midfield, you know, that's kind of right in the middle, not only in the field, but you know, wing backs, full backs, and wingers are kind of in the forefront. They're the ones that really decline fast, where speed is of the utmost importance. You know, goalkeepers, center backs, and strikers are.
Yeah, problem for a centre midfield player, again, without getting the data, instinctively, the problem for me is the players in front of you, beside you, on either side, and behind you. A striker's got the play coming to him, so getting back to your trade off between wisdom and pace, he can minimise the decline in pace by the increase in wisdom because the play's all happening. He can see it coming, and again with the centre half, he can see the play evolving in front of him, and so the trade-off, and that's why goalkeepers probably last the longest of all, when goalkeepers regularly can be pushing towards 40, because they can, there's so much they can trade off the wisdom of being in position, because they've got time to see the play evolving around them. And the biggest challenge for a midfielder is the player's all 360 degrees.
Yeah, and that's, again, the profile of Brown. If he was an elite creative passer, right, to use a crazy outlier, like a Pirlo.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody could sit deep, and maybe he's losing a step, but, man, the value from that creative passing from the midfield is so high that absorbing the decline in defensive production is tolerable, right? And the team's still better for that person playing. You know, so again, I keep saying, I mean, it shouldn't be hard. Like this is, from my background, this is as clean cut an analytics case as you come across. Like it just, this is, it's so hard for me to not say something that I'll regret. So I'll just, I mean, it really should not be something that is controversial. But then again, like I said, in 2004, when baseball teams started to have their fat guy lead off, right? The fat guy who walks a lot leading off, you had people screaming from the rafters. Why isn't that small, fast guy who steals 50 bases a year leading off anymore? Right? So I get it. But the analytical case is, I mean, to argue the analytics, which some people will do, I mean, if you're going to argue over that, this is not the hill to die on analytically, in my opinion, right? Whether, you know, some of my opinions on whether we should play two up top or, you know, the space that Elianusi occupies with Edouard and all that stuff, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about there. Like, that's me maybe thinking I have an idea. This Brown conversation is like, you know, is the earth flat or isn't it? I mean, this is that fundamental.
So on, with it, you know, now that we've finished our character assassination of Scott Brown, on the, and I'm joking, it's really, as I say, what I'm asking you to speak on is my gut feel based on, he's a 35-year-old guy, he's obviously going to be in decline. What are the numbers saying about it? And the numbers are saying, get him out of there.
Let me amend that.
Yeah.
You know, as they say, there's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics,
mm-hmm.
right? The old saying. And that's because if you are in the midst of cognitive dissonance and you're looking for confirmation bias to justify something, you will find stats to align with your bias, right? So, like I said, Brown's interceptions are absolutely still terrific. They're you know, way up there, even within his peer group in Europe. His ball recoveries are still pretty good. They've been softening a little bit more, again, because I think that's more physical than interceptions, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes sense with the decline curve. But his volumes of duels and tackles, all that's following a very normal. So, again, if I want to confirm my bias, I'll just point out his interceptions are still elite. You know, so that's where the generation of where we're at in football data capture is still pretty early, right? So there will come a time in the next few years where, you know, somebody like Celtic should have data knowing that Brown is sprinting at a 20% lower speed than he was 4 or 5 years ago, and that his peer group is X, and that, you know, it'll be a lot more direct, hopefully, to be able to make certain decisions. So, like I said, I get it. Like, if you want to come up with a narrative to justify a bias, it's going to be there. I mean, he's not a bad player. It's not like he's an embarrassment to walk out on the field.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about in Scotland either. I mean, he's going to be fine in the SPFL against most of the teams, right? I'm talking about optimizing, right? I want to see us hammer a bunch of teams 5-0. Okay, I'm a greedy jerk, right? I want to see us set a goal record this year, which I think we legitimately could do if we keep it Edward. And let's say we had a guy like a Jetty. I mean, there's no reason why we can't, with the disparity in our league, average 3 goals a game, right? That's my opinion. It's in Europe, and it's back to this conversation about risk, right? So a lot of Celtic supporters, I think, are dissatisfied with where we've been in Europe for a while now. And I'm in that group. But I really do think, as I look at the risks stacking up, it gets to be existential. And when I say existential, way higher than they should be relative to potentially losing the league this year. And I think the risks are much higher than the vast majority of probably people at the club and certainly amongst our support thinks it is. And that's where you get back into probabilities. I had a discussion with this nice gentleman on Twitter. I think it was yesterday, the day before. I sent out a tweet basically saying that I just checked the odds, the bookie odds, and that Rangers are now 36% to win the league, implied odds based on their I forget what they were, plus 300 or something. I forget what it was. And Celtic were basically 67% favorites to win it. And I basically said, well, the morning of the election, the best odds for the 2016 U.S. election had Trump below 36%, right? And I had this discussion with this gentleman. He's a nice guy. I mean, we've had exchanges in the past, but he was arguing with me that they're different. And I said, no, they're not different. It's a binary outcome. Either Trump wins or he loses. Either Celtic will win the league or they won't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Binary outcome. It's probabilities. Like it's like arguing the law of gravity. This is something that you shouldn't argue with.
Yep.
It's right. So I don't think most people understand, and I think those odds are probably a little low because of the risks. I mean, I don't know if the bookmakers machine learning algorithm is picking up the transcript from your podcast, or has a wire into Edouard's agent's office and knows the risk of maybe Edouard leaving. So what would the odds be if Edouard left? I don't know, right? So it's a dynamic market. So that's this idea of mispriced risk. And I would argue if we do not qualify for the Champions League, it's just commonsensically, like based on our record in Europe and based off some of the decisions Lennon's made in some of these games. I mean, again, I don't know if it's Lennon, I don't know if it's Kennedy, but the management team, I'd like to hear how many Celtic supporters would say us winning three single games in a row and then winning a knockout tie is a slam dunk. I don't know who would say that and actually believe it. I think it should be close to a slam dunk. I mean, I think we're that much better than most of these teams that we're going to face, that it shouldn't be that close. But then again, you get into risk, a red card, an injury, you know, some of these things that you just can't plan for. So back to this, why are we layering on unforced errors, unforced risks, unnecessary risks? I think we need to be removing as much risk as possible because we're already in a situation where the risks are elevated because of the pandemic, the fixture clog, and the way that the knockout stage is going to be for qualification. So the transfer window being delayed. I mean, there's just a lot of things lining up here.
Yeah.
You layer them on top, it's like, wow, there's a lot that could go sideways here.
So I know it's a small data sample, but from the pre-season friendlies, who are the players, are there any players in the fringe section that you think should be moving from Lennon's fringe second choice 11 that he's played in the, because he's principally played two teams in the he's played a team that's patently his first choice 11 and a team that's his second choice 11. Who, if anyone, in any position should be moving from the second 11 to the first 11 and vice versa?
Well, so listeners won't know this, but when Harry and I logged on here for Skype, I had a background screen that was a heat map with scribbling on it that said Free and Cham as a joke. So in my mind, the fact that Cham is not a locked-in starter is borderline crazy. So I think, you know, there's an honest debate and discussion if Brown is going to start. And again, I fully expect he will, hence the risk, the unnecessary risk. But I think there's a legitimate honest debate between Cham and Christie. I don't think, you know, my opinion is neither one of them are best at a 10. I think they're both better eights. And this goes back to this. I just don't understand why we keep playing the midfield the way we do. Even in the PSG game, I was so excited. I joked on Twitter. I was like, I don't know. You know, I was afraid that we were going to lose 10-0 in this midfield I've been longing to see, which we literally have only seen once. We've only seen one game with those three players in the midfield together, which we gave up 0 XG. We literally had no shots on goal in that game. I forget which game it was, but we didn't give up. So there goes the, you know, small sample, obviously only one game, but clearly they can play defense together. That they lined up with, you know, basically Christie is a 10. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an amoeba type. You know, we were changing when we were kind of a 5-4-1 into like a 4-3-3 maybe, or 4-2-3-1 in attack. But if you're going to play Brown, this goes back to this progression that Rodgers made. If you're going to play Brown, I don't understand why he's not a central six. Like the idea that he should be pressing and all of the problems that creates in transition defense and the lopsidedness of our attack then because of how much better McGregor is in creating. You know, so you could argue, should it be Christie or in Cham? That's a good argument to have. Like I could, you know, as my beloved grandfather used to say, I feel strongly both ways. Mm-hmm. Right. So I could see that being a debate. It could be situational, it could be matchup. But as I've been documenting and talking about, is if you look at our problems against Rangers the last 2 years and in Europe, we don't score enough. End of story. We do not create enough chances. You know, we talk about how many goals we scored domestically, how attacking we are, but we have struggled to have an XG of one in Europe. Last year was a little above one. You know, we always give up these crazy goals, and it's amazing. This is one of the things that I've learned in the last decade as becoming more of a football fan, is everyone thinks that their center backs are terrible.
Yeah.
No matter what, right? So if you look at our defensive performance with Iyer and Julian, even in Europe, like, they've been really good, objectively. I mean, mm-hmm. Did they make mistakes? Did Jozo make a horrible mistake? Of course. Center backs make mistakes. Most goals are scored because of mistakes. But our problem has not been defending. Our problem has been creating chances. Mm-hmm. And this circles back to our midfield. And are we getting enough creativity out of our midfield? I would argue no. And there's been some white papers written in the last couple of years looking at trying to quantify the impact of having that creativity in midfield and how it's not linear, right? So it's not linear like you would think an XG model would be. It's like, mm-hmm. if you have someone like in Cham pinging those passes that break down lines into certain zones, you get a multiplier effect. You know, it's exponential as far as your increased chances of creating good quality scoring opportunities. And intuitively, that makes sense to me. So confirmation bias granted. But it also fits with where we've been lacking. So if you combine our lopsidedness that better teams are clearly game planning for and pushing us left with our need for more creativity, I mean, it just, and throw in there that we looked really good in the Europa League under Rodgers against Leipzig. And we had a little rougher time with Salzburg. But again, Salzburg, it's an unfair fight right now because mm-hmm. Salzburg is, you know, they're on the cutting edge of this. So they're game planning every team that they're going up against, I surmise, using machine learning. And they're putting together game plans to pick people apart based off of that. So we had a little trouble with Salzburg. But in those other games, I mean, we looked great. Christine and McGregor were just fine in midfield, with Roger, by the way. So
would you play, so tell me about, I'm just conscious of the time here, yep. Rogic, would you, which I used to call him, just by the way, I used to call him Rogic, like everybody else does, until a guy messaged me and said, I'm Croatian, it's Rogic.
Yeah. You know, what's funny. So I have my own bias on Rogic, right? So it's funny you say that, because I just did something, my 2-hour coffee this morning. I pulled up our 20 best XG games in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Just curious. I'm like, I'm gonna look at these and see if I can pick up any tendencies, right? So I have the spreadsheet that I created in front of me as we talk here. So out of those 20 games, let's stipulate, Rogic has played over that time just under 7,000 minutes, which is the equivalent of about 77 games, 90-minute blocks, right? So not a lot, even mm-hmm. though... given that he's been here that whole time. Out of the 20, he was involved in 14.
Right.
So almost 20% of his matches that he played at the time in matches were in games that we had our highest XG output in the last five seasons. Now, obviously, most of those are against the likes of bottom of the table teams, mm-hmm. St. Mirren and Hamilton. There's the one glorious one against Rangers in there. The 5-0. There's one against Aberdeen. But so he sticks out, and interestingly, Christie sticks out. But Christie with Roderick.
Right.
Right. So the games that Christie played with Roderick have.
Where Christie's an eight.
Yes. A disproportionate. Yeah. So you when you had a. Particularly when you had McGregor, Christie, and Roderick, that threesome, they are overrepresented in this sample. Right. Beton sticks out. So I've had this debate with my friend Alan Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I've come around to the idea that he is an attractive central defender, and his defense is good enough now. And I mean, I think people forget how good of a footballer he is, right? I mean, his last year under Dyla was close. It was in the neighborhood of Brown, good Brown, like player of the year under Rodgers Brown, right? Which was a legit great year. Like, all of the stats backed that up. I mean, it was lined up. And Beaton that season, 15-16, was pretty close. Like, he wasn't quite there, but really good. And one of the things that he, and one of the metrics that Allen tracks called pack passes, he's always stood out in that, right? So back to what we talked about earlier about the importance of that and that creativity. Well, I've loved him when he's played in the back three, right? He's just intuitive. You see the lines he breaks. Like, I remember that 29th game against Rangers when we switched to the back three, and then Cham came on and Beaton came on, and all of a sudden Frimpong lit up. Right. All of a sudden we just started we took over the game. Like, I remember that game. I was ranting and raving. I was screaming like everyone else how terrible we were. Right. And then when I looked at the numbers afterwards, it was basically even. But most of how we caught up to them in the numbers was the last, I think it was 27 minutes when we went 3-5-2 and Beaton was linking up with Cham on that right side. And Cham is an eight, Beaton is the right central center back, right? So one of the things I don't have the horsepower, I don't have the data science, I don't have the data, but if I was an analyst with access to that data, I would be running some kind of model to figure out, if I have multiple of these talented pack passers in one team, right? So if I have and Rogic fits that as a 10, right? I mean, he probably isn't as good in that role. I'm intuiting this. I might be wrong on this, but I would theorize that he probably isn't as good as an eight as he is as a 10. But if you have players behind him, like an Encham and a McGregor, who are really good at that, playing with someone like that in a 10, then you might get this compounding effect, a nonlinear exponential growth, shall we say, in chance creation. Right, so I would theorize, and this is where you get back to the analytics and testing. So I would want to test that. I would say, okay, what would that look like? Right. So long-winded answer. My bias is that Rogic is too slow for Europe. He's not quick enough. He doesn't press enough. Right. So especially the way that our managers have wanted to play in Europe. But I can't get away from the fact of what I just said, and the fact that he was the 10 in that run in Europa League with Christie and McGregor. And we did pretty well. So maybe that's my bias.
My bias against Rogic is people will always throw goals that Rogic has scored at me. Yeah. And my point is always, he's a midfield player. If he was, I'll put up with a striker who does nothing for 89 minutes but put the ball in the back of the net, I'll not put up with a midfielder who's anonymous for three quarters of the game and puts the ball in the back of the net. And my issue, I'm exaggerating with the anonymous for three quarters of the game. Yeah. My issue is there are large chunks of the game where he is missing.
Yeah, and obviously he's had his issues with fitness. And so peak Rogic, which, again, I have access to data to 15-16, right? So I can't go back farther than that. So I don't think he was... You know, I think his best year probably was 16-17 under Rodgers. So if you use that as his peak, Christie's output last year combined with Cham in that 10 role was pretty much comparable. And again, that's with them two, I would argue, not playing their best position. So Rodgers is a really good player. Like, I actually, based on his physical profile, again, I'd be looking to sell him. Like, this is the time to sell him.
Yep.
Because he's already not elite in athleticism from the sense of speed and quickness. I mean, I think his vision and his intuition and, you know, that's obviously also athleticism, but kind of his raw athleticism, I think, is already subpar. And that's going to get worse quickly here in the next couple of years. So, one of the guys, Andrew McKay, that follows me on Twitter, made a comment that I thought was really insightful that I had thought of. was, you know, if you're going to sign a David Turnbull, I think he's more of a, you know, I would swap him for Roger, you know, in a second. Especially if we could pick up some money to do it, especially with the backdrop of who we have on the team right now. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Roger could have his place. Like I said, terrific player. But it's kind of the same thing with Griffiths. Like if you can't rely on someone to be fit, again, we're piling on the risk factors, right? So yeah. I go back to this squad depth, squad fitness, going into this room this year and all the different kinds of variables and risks that can pile on. And I'd rather, you know, have avoidable risks mitigated.
So I'm going to run through, just to bring things to a close, I'm going to run through the stuff that I heard today, mm-hmm. and tell me what your thoughts are. So, Barkas is signing, the goalkeeper. We are likely to sell in Cham.
Yep.
Replace him with Turnbull and... I can't remember the player's name. The Rapid Vienna.
I saw that. That was an interesting one. I saw you post that, and I looked him up. I wasn't familiar with him, so I looked him up. I don't know. To me, he profiles as a basically Brown. So I don't know.
Yeah. So
I mean, and in fairness, there was all that heat around Wanyama last summer.
Yeah.
And again, you know. We get into this. I don't want to come across as that guy. I am the American that hates Scott Brown, though. And people forgot real quick about the social media thing that Brown liked after the Cluj debacle that was critical of Lennon. So who knows? I mean, who knows what's going on behind the scenes?
You wouldn't mind the idea would be we would settle in Cham, sign those two, and still have money Ajeti is, and again this was Ajeti is signing on loan with an option to buy, and we might sell Aya.
Yeah, you know,
and sign two centre halves.
Yeah. Ayer should be sold from a business perspective. Like if you look at his value and, you know, rumblings that he's not interested in signing an extension. So with him being 2 years left on his deal, I mean, I like Ayer. I mean, I think he gets a lot of shtick because he goes to the ground too much, which he probably does. And he's made some high profile errors, which, you know, again, that's the name of the game for that position. He can't head a ball offensively to save his life. Fair enough. But overall, I mean, if you look at, again, Alan Morrison's done some good reporting on this with his data, is that, I mean, he and Julian, just strictly from a defending perspective, a quality, are as close as we've seen to Van Dijk. And the stuff I've looked at basically aligns with that. I mean, I don't do the things exactly the same as Alan, but most of the stuff I looked at confirmed that. So that's going to be tough to replace. It introduces risk. Mm-hmm. I don't hate the Encham sale in so much as if we're going to insist on playing the system, right? So that was why I was a little cautious about the Elyounoussi return signing, because that, to me, that suggested that two up top was pretty much dead. Now, I might be wrong on that, but and maybe they'll use it. Elyounoussi is a 10 somehow. Mm-hmm. And I actually wouldn't hate that, because he played that. I looked at that this week. He actually had a run at Basel and was productive doing that. But if you're not going to play in Cham at an 8 and he's not going to be a locked on starter, you know, again, if I take my green and white glasses off, if I'm in Cham, I don't want to stay around. Mm-hmm. Why would he stay?
Yep.
I mean, I wouldn't say strolled it, but he was clearly not outside his element playing against PSG. And he was easily our, you know, the most obvious player that we had on the pitch that day that didn't stick out. I would argue, I mean, a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot. There were a fair number of people critical of McGregor's performance. I actually thought he was really good, and the stats backed that up. But so, I mean, and one area that people, I don't think people realize that are adopting this data analytics, because if you think about Darwinism and making money, which, you know, money makes the world go round, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, but it's true, are agents. And if I'm an Enchant's agent and I say, well, you know, this club's benching you, you're sitting on the bench so that Brown can play, which that's effectively a swap. That, it's not Christie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, if I totally take my glasses off and say, if I'm that player's agent, if I put myself in those shoes, I would be telling Cham to move on.
So would I.
I mean, he'd be crazy to stay, especially if he's going to double his wage and he's going to, you know, go back to France or play in Italy or something. I mean,
And Cham just strikes me as a guy who is not a first choice pick at Celtic, and in 2 years' time will be playing quarterfinals Champions League. And we'll be sitting watching going, he was on our bench.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can't say I disagree. And, but I also, and when I say I don't hate this, if we did sell him, I think Turnbull does profile pretty well as a 10. And I if you look at his ninth, you know, again, this is something I get from my baseball analytics background, which is basically looking at people's age season, right? So his age 19 season with Motherwell before he was injured,
mm-hmm.
he produced at a level in attack that was comparable to peak Rodrick. And that's looking at XG and XA. He outperformed his XG. Like, I don't expect him to forever be making as many shots from outside of the 18 as he did that season. Like, he significantly outperformed. By the way, so did Christie last season, so he probably won't either. But so I think he, you know, I'm excited about it. I think he would be a good signing, and, you know, assuming his knee is structurally sound, obviously he's going to be fit. So do I think there would be a major shift in Cham playing 10 versus Turnbull playing 10? I don't know. I would say I'd be comfortable that there would be comparable. But in fairness to Cham, I think that's him playing out of position. It's just like, you know, Christie's a decent winger when he plays wing, but he's not a winger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think Christie's a 10 either. But that comes back to system. So what I will be fascinated to watch is if a Jetty arrives and they make that kind of switch. When I say switch, you know, sell in Cham and sign Turnbull. I'll be fascinated. And if they bring in the guy from Vienna, I mean, who knows? I would be really interested to see how they would set up. And the reason why I like Adjetey is because I really like that idea as I looked at it this week, because he profiles as somebody who, you know, we're not going to get another Dembele Edouard back-to-back. You know, it's like hitting the lottery twice in a row. You know, thinking about the time that we had between Larson and Dembele. I mean, there was some good strikers in there, but just
yeah.
Not quite that level. So the idea that we're going to get another Dembele or another Enchan or Edouard, I think Adjetey looks, you know, really good for what we could expect. And more conventional, like in a 4-2-3-1, I think he profiles more as the one. Like, he actually is in the box a lot. You know, like, I love Edouard, but, you know, he's just not inside the 18 all that much. He drops a lot. And, you know, again, when we get into Europe, so I think he profiles really well with Edouard if we play two up top, probably domestically on a rare occasion. It seems like we might do that. And then I'll be interested to see what they do in Europe. I mean, I suspect because of risk aversion, right? So if I'm Neil Lennon and I'm not a huge tactics guy and I sure as heck I'm not a big data machine learning guy, the last thing I want to do or have on my gravestone is that I blew 10 in a row because I didn't play Scott Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And while I think analytically that is not a sound deduction, there's not a zero risk that that would happen. Right. And while I think that the risks would dramatically increase in Celtics' favor if they change the midfield mix, it doesn't mean they're going to win the league. You know, Donald Trump is president of the United States. So, you know, things you don't think are going to happen or won't happen, happen all the time, even when they're relatively low probability. And people have a hard time thinking of probabilities. So even if it gets down to 20% chance at Rangers are going to win the league. You know, some mistimed red cards and the fact that the rest of the league might be down a lot. And maybe the officiating's refereeing's crazy like I speculated earlier. And so we have some big injuries. You know, who knows? If I'm Neil Lennon, do I want to absorb that risk? Right? So, again, when you think about risk, what's the frontal lobe risk that people are going to be thinking at the club? Because
mm-hmm.
10 in a row is all consuming. And, you know, losing it with Brown not being a cornerstone would be cataclysmic. I mean, that would, there might be a riot. yeah, I mean, that's how crazy that would be. I'm theorizing. I mean, people would really be upset. So, I mean, I think it would only be human to, even if it's subconscious, to have that kind of thing rattling in one's brain, as you know, people prepare and start thinking about what they're going to do.
Okay, well, with that, just conscious of the time, I will definitely get you on again. I'll see Duco James. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Harry. It's been a pleasure.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Hope you enjoyed that podcast. I just love getting stats and figures that either back up what I think I'm seeing or that challenge my views on things. So if you want to follow him at Duco James on Twitter and you'll see more of him, we'll definitely have more on the podcast, and I hope to do one more podcast before the league starts, season preview. Anyway, enough of me. That was him, Duco James, with me, Harry Brady, talking about data, statistics, and Scott Brown. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless.
As the sun from up above, bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. This world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.